Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to those committed to leveraging innovation to make the world a better place. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Yesterday, in a hastily scheduled hearing of the January 6th committee, former White House Chief of Staff aide Cassidy Hutchinson related a series of conversations about what Donald Trump did and knew on Jan 6th. According to her testimony, he knew his supporters were armed, wanted them to go to the Capitol. He tried to join them, and he refused to do anything to stop them, despite knowing they were armed, dangerous, and searching for legislators and even his own Vice President, Mike Pence. We'll discuss Hutchinson's testimony in the context of the rest of the January 6th hearings and the broader assault on our democratic processes. That's coming up next, after this news. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. As the 2020 election rolled towards its conclusion, Republican operatives across the country were preparing to win by changing the rules on how votes would be counted. But as their plans faltered on the integrity of some election officials, a darker plan emerged. It culminated in the January 6th riot that followed Donald Trump's rally nearby in Washington, D.C. Many of Donald Trump's supporters have denied that Trump was responsible for the bloodshed at the Capitol, setting up cascading lines of defense about what Trump supposedly did not know or condone. These excuses always felt improbable, but Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, drawn from her time as a young Republican aide deep inside the White House, contradicts the idea that Donald Trump did not know the Capitol rioters were armed and intending to stop the certification of the election by force. Here to talk about Hutchinson's testimony and the effect it may or may not have on the hearings and the country, we're joined by Nicholas Wu, a reporter covering Congress with Politico. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amy Allison, founder of She the People, an organization elevating the political voice of women of color. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you back. And Ankush Kadori, a lawyer based in Washington and also a contributing writer for New York Magazine's Intelligencer and a contributing editor at Politico Magazine. Welcome, Ankush.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with you, Nick. I mean, this was a hastily called hearing. It's not exactly clear why that is, but it was quite dramatic and kind of the first surprise witness since Watergate. Can you talk to us a little bit about how this set up, at least as political theater?
Well, this hearing came as an absolute surprise to reporters. As was previously mentioned, Congress is out this week. Most members aren't in town. And so the committee gave about 24 hours notice for this hearing, which kept a lot of Washington guessing over who the witness could be. That leaked out overnight. And then we saw this explosive testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson in the afternoon. And so it's rare that secrets like this are so closely held in Washington. And the committee promised big revelations, and it seems that they delivered.
So tell us a little bit about, for people who weren't watching the hearings or, you know, haven't sort of dug into who Cassidy Hutchinson is, you know, it's not a name that has come up in the way that many other people in the sort of Trump extended universe have. Can you tell us a little bit about what her role was and why she may or may have been in position to hear these conversations?
So Cassidy Hutchinson was basically the right hand to Mark Meadows in the White House, the chief of staff towards the end of the Trump administration. And in that position, she was basically in a spot to be in and around the room where it happened and to be part of these conversations during these crucial machinations at the end of Trump's presidency. And so while she is a relatively young figure and definitely not a household name prior to yesterday, I mean, clearly she was someone who was willing to take the stand under oath and talk to the world about what she saw on January 6th and in the lead up to it.
Yeah. Ankush, let's come to you. You know, there's a lot of different objectives to these hearings, but from a legal perspective, what are the big outstanding questions that you went into this hearing wanting to know or thought that this kind of testimony could help resolve?
Well, I think the foremost sort of theory, if you will, that Hutchinson's testimony advanced or attempted to advance was that Trump was aware of and crucially intended to foment violence outside of the Capitol. That is like what the intended takeaway was. And we can talk about how powerful Hutchinson's testimony was on that point, what sorts of ambiguities there were surrounding certain discrete pieces of it. But to the extent that the committee has sort of laid out this, you know, very expansive, what Cheney described as sort of a 7-point sophisticated plan that they were going to lay out over the course of these hearings, Hutchinson's was about kind of this particular aspect of these multiple theories that the committee is pursuing, this one being the violence.
I mean, and it sounds like you're a little bit skeptical that it nailed down that piece of the case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying, as I hear all of this testimony come in, just trying to put on my sort of skeptic's hat, if you will. So I think that the kind of most salacious, if you will, takeaway had to do with, to me at least, Trump insisting that armed people be allowed to attend his speech before they eventually headed on to the Capitol. Trump wanted to go, but eventually was prevented from going to the Capitol. But that drew a lot of attention, and rightly so. Hutchinson recalled that Trump basically said, you know, they're not here to hurt me. Let them in. And there's one way to interpret that comment, which is that Trump is an extremely reckless narcissist, allowing people to come in armed because he wants to increase the size of his crowd. In fact, that is what Hutchinson said she thought was likely motivating his comments. Her testimony, however, I think has been interpreted as by a lot of people, and I think kind of intentionally, to be honest, this was the implication, deliberate implication by Cheney and the committee, as indicating that Trump actually wanted armed people in the crowd so that they could proceed to the Capitol and participate in a potential armed siege of the Capitol. And you can interpret it that way, right? People are allowed to draw inferences, use their circumstantial evidence to kind of plug gaps in our knowledge and the like. But there's a big difference between those two scenarios. And I honestly don't think it's being aired out as thoughtfully as it should be.
You know, let's listen into the cut so that people can get the full context for themselves. This is when Cassidy Hutchinson's talking about Trump's concern that the crowd at the rally would look too small and blaming security and the mags that you're going to hear in this cut. Those basically are, you know, metal detectors screened for weapons.
He wanted it to be full and for people to not feel excluded because they'd come far to watch him at the rally. And he felt the mags were at fault for not letting everybody in. But another leading reason, and likely the primary reason, is because he wanted it full and he was angry that we weren't letting people through the mags with weapons, what the Secret Service deems as weapons and our weapons. But when we were in the offstage announced tent, I was part of a conversation. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in.
So just, you know, having just listened back to that directly, I mean, you're right that there's maybe some step missing there. It comes down to a lot of maybe even the precise where the emphasis was laid in what Donald Trump said. They're, you know, they're not here to hurt me, or, you know, they're not here to hurt anyone, kind of in that sense. But it's a pretty small step, right? I mean, she's saying that he knew they were armed and knew they would go on to the Capitol. Are we like splitting hairs too finely here?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, look, people, but by the same token, people are free to say this is one piece of information that is part of a broader mosaic, right? And so to interpret this one comment in isolation is maybe myopic, right? So people can and should, you know, integrate it into their fuller understanding, which is hard to do in real time. I don't think it's splitting hairs because for a couple of reasons. One, there's not to repeat myself, but there's just a very big difference between someone saying running a risk with their own safety because they want to increase the size of the audience that they're speaking to. And Trump has a very well-known predilection for for crowd sizes, or potentially maybe the crowd size comment was a pretext and he deliberately wanted people in the audience so that they could proceed onto the Capitol and lay siege to the Capitol. I mean, it is a small step, but a material step, a material discrepancy between the two. And by the way, the questions at a proceeding like this are chosen carefully. And this committee had spoken to Hutchinson on several occasions before yesterday. I don't want to be, again, like sort of overly skeptical, but I do find it curious that Cheney just didn't straight up ask her what she thought Trump's intention was. Or more to the point, do you think Trump deliberately wanted people in so that they could then proceed to the Capitol and that was his intention, right? And Hutchinson could have said, yes, no, I don't know. But I can pretty much guarantee you that at some point during the multiple interviews that preceded yesterday, someone asked her that question. Mm-hmm. My guess, and it is only a guess, is the answer was not as damning as they would have liked, or we would have heard that Q&A repeated yesterday.
Amy Allison, founder of She the People, we've been focusing on some of the legal issues here, but what's important for you to get out of these hearings? Is it potential prosecutions, just shining a light on what happened, like reaching people outside of the media bubble who listen to shows like Forum, who are probably well acquainted with the issues we're talking about here?
Well, let's not get lost in the forest for the trees, because yesterday's testimony gave damning proof of sedition. It's worth us revisiting the actual definition of what sedition is. It's the act of a person forcefully trying to overthrow, take down, hinder, or delay the government or its laws through words or speech. What Cassidy Hutchinson, her witness, really pointed to was the picture of Trump as a seditious and criminal president. And the picture of a mad king, someone was unhinged, and really laid out a legal, moral, and political case that we must not only recognize his acts as seditious, but really laying out the case that we have to act appropriately. I mean, this isn't the time for us to really focus on just the narcissism or the personality of Trump. It's time, and this testimony really points to, now that we've heard Cassidy Hutchinson really recount what she could in terms of what she saw and the impact of those, we have to acknowledge that sedition is a very serious offense, one of the most serious, and that the purpose of Trump's actions was in fact to hinder, overthrow, take down the government or laws through words or speech. That's what we're dealing with now, and that's what yesterday's testimony pointed to.
We're talking about the latest news from the House Committee hearings on the January 6th attack on the Capitol with Amy Allison, founder of She the People, an organization elevating the political voice of women of color. Ankush Kadori, a lawyer based in Washington, has been writing a lot about this. And Nicholas Wu, a reporter covering Congress for Politico. And we do want to hear from you. What questions do you have about Hutchinson's testimony during the January 6th hearings? The number is 866-733-6786. Stay tuned for more after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the latest news from the House committee hearings on the January 6th attack on the Capitol with Nicholas Wu, reporter covering Congress with Politico, Amy Allison, founder of She the People, and Ankush Kodori, a lawyer based in Washington, who's a contributing writer for New York Magazine's Intelligencer, has a new piece out on Hutchinson's testimony if you want to check that out. Also contributing editor at Politico Magazine. Phone lines are lighting up. We do want to hear from you what questions you have about the testimony that we heard yesterday in the hearings. The number is 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's KQED Forum. And, of course, you know the email. It's forum@kqed.org. I want to get a little bit deeper into some of Cassidy Hutchinson, Mark Meadows' chief of staff, Mark Meadows' aide, Trump's chief of staff aide, particularly around Donald Trump's desire to join the mob growing at the Capitol. Let's listen into her testimony on that.
The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president. Take me up to the Capitol now." To which Bobby responded, "Sir, we have to go back to the West Wing." The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
Yeah. Nicholas Wu, reporter covering Congress. This clip is probably the most played clip from the testimony. What do we know about how people have been responding to the kind of pushback on this particular piece of testimony?
This allegation, out of all the others aired yesterday, seems to have generated the most pushback from Republicans in particular, who've called it hearsay and have accused Hutchinson of not telling the truth. But we'll have to see exactly how the committee tries to corroborate this narrative. I mean, when the committee has made similarly explosive allegations before, they've been able to back it up with the goods. And Hutchinson, we have to remember, was under oath when she delivered this testimony. But as we're reporting right now, the Secret Service is actually saying that in the 10 days before this hearing, the committee did not reach out to them for more details about this altercation in the president's limousine, which is nicknamed the Beast. And so there's a number of people who would be able to speak to this. Robert Engel, for example, who is the head of Trump's security detail. We know that he's gone in with the committee before and has given them testimony. And we might see a circumstance in which the committee decides to bring him back for additional testimony. We've seen them do that with other witnesses before. And so the committee investigators have stressed that they're welcoming anyone to come before them and provide testimony. And the Secret Service has made clear that they would okay their personnel going in with the committee without a subpoena. And so we'll have to wait and see exactly how this plays out. But you're very right. This is definitely one of the most explosive allegations from Tuesday's hearing.
You know, Ankush Kodori, you know, grabbing the wheel is obviously cinematic, and it has, you know, that kind of allegation of going after your own secret, you know, that gives that Mad King feel that Amy Allison was talking about earlier. As a legal matter, though, grab the wheel or just saying you want to go, kind of the same thing, right? I mean, there's not too much difference there on a legal basis, or is there?
You're right. You're right. Also, in terms of the man's temperament, We also obviously we heard the testimony about how he throws his food at the walls when he hears things he doesn't like in the West Wing. But on that particular point, one way to look at it, and a lot of people did, I think, say, okay, this is assault, right? Particularly the testimony about he lunched or whatever. Hutchins had made very clear she was not present for this.
Yeah.
This, she was recounting something else that she heard, which is hearsay. In terms of like kind of the legal significance of it, ordinarily, like you can't lunge at people, right? Even if you don't make contact, you can't lunge at people. It's assault. In this instance, it's a little complicated by the fact that this is Trump's security detail and he is the president. So if you wanted to put yourself in, please nobody shoot the messenger here, but if you wanted to put the most charitable gloss on what happened, he's kind of resisting what he thinks is, or he may regard as kind of being kidnapped, if you will, right? Or being like kind of accosted and taken somewhere against his will and against his authority.
Right, right. And she, in other ways, Hutchinson makes clear that the president wanted to go to the Capitol and his security detail was saying it wasn't safe. And there's a larger context to this. We have a caller, Corey, in San Francisco, who wanted to respond to something you said, I think, on Kush. Yes, Corey?
Yeah, your skeptical guest is being very generous in his skepticism. You have a president who, one, knew the crowd was armed. That's clear. And two, said he didn't care and that they should march to the Capitol. And then invited them to march the Capitol in his speech. So we have him publicly telling them to march the Capitol after he told them he didn't care they were armed. So he knew they were armed, told them to march the Capitol. How is that not telling a mob, an armed mob, to march on the Capitol? I don't think his crowd size justification works for that.
Or why not?
Well,
both? Right.
Or let me put it. Can I put it slightly differently, reframe the question here? Because part of the problem that question reflects is she has fully adopted the framing that the committee chose to present yesterday. I think the committee has done an excellent job, but they are picking and choosing which facts they want to present and in what order and how prominently. So let's just take a big step back here. If Trump wanted there to be an armed siege of the Capitol, someone should testify to that before we all go around assuming that the case has been established. And by the way, we have heard no testimony yet. It's supposed to be the subject of further hearings indicating that Trump told anyone not to prepare responsibly, any of his cabinet officials or the federal agencies, not to prepare for January 6th. That he overruled any plan for security at the Capitol, either in the run-up to or on January 6th itself, that he refused to approve any sort of security response the afternoon of January 6th, all things that would not be necessary to like establishing Trump's malicious intent. But if you are investigating someone and your hypothesis is that they deliberately planted a mob somewhere, and that person happens to supervise the people in charge of security, the facts that were just laid out by the caller would not be the end of any responsible investigation. I'm sorry.
Let me jump in, Alex, if I can.
Sure. Amy Allison, go ahead.
Listen, let's take even further step back. The testimony we heard from Cassidy Hutchinson yesterday about Trump grabbing the wheel, really take the step back and see what he was trying to do, his intent. What he wanted to do, and we heard the testimony, is he wanted to lead the armed mob that stormed the Capitol. He wanted to be there. There was conversation and testimony about him wanting to go into the floor of the House of Representatives. That's what he'd intended. And if it wasn't for his security detail, perhaps it's not even just a scene. That's the intent. Now, he's not a regular, like an ordinary citizen. He's the sitting president of the United States at that time, you know, and that testimony yesterday gave proof that both Trump as president understood
that his supporters were armed. He encouraged the armed mob to go to the Capitol. He rallied popular support, supposedly in the name of people, but he was willing to do anything to vie for absolute rule. We know what that looks like. Other countries have had this. That's fascism. And so it's time for us here in this country to recognize what it is and not justify it. And I really think the question for us as a people, as an American people, is what are we going to do in the face of sedition? What's the appropriate response? And how do we reestablish the political norms and cultural democratic norms in the face of what we heard yesterday, in the face of what we actually witnessed, all of us witnessed in January 6th?
You know, I think I wanted to add a little bit of context myself here. I mean, we've had Barton Gellman on the show, Atlantic investigative journalist, and it was pretty clear that there were many, even if it wasn't Trump himself, there were many people within the Republican kind of apparatus who understood disrupting the certification of the election on January 6th as a really significant thing to do. Like, just that they're actually stopping that could have had meaningful consequences for the other things that they were trying to get done. And I think, you know, that to me, that is where this violence and where sending people to the Capitol really has a lot of significance. Nicholas Wood, do you get the sense that these hearings are changing things for the people in Congress that you report on?
It's a little soon to say how exactly this is changing things in Congress, but it is worth remembering that the attack itself changed how Congress operates entirely. It broke down a lot of the bipartisan relations that have been made between Republicans and Democrats. And remember, we had there was a time when Democrats would refuse to even co-sponsor bills with some Republicans who had objected to the election results. But moving forward from that, I mean, the revelations that are produced by this committee are fairly damning too for Republican members of Congress, right? We've seen witnesses testify to the fact that Republican members of Congress sought pardons after January 6th. We've seen Republican members of Congress implicated in the false electors scheme. In a chamber where, you know, bipartisan relations are already at an all-time low, there could be quite a long tail end of an effect from these hearings.
Yeah. Let's bring in another caller, Dan from Santa Clara. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A quick comment, I think your attorney there is pushing back upon the idea that this is conclusive proof. And if not, it's persuasive and compelling testimony. Simply put, that's the distinction going on here. I believe Mrs. Hutchinson. That's what persuasive and compelling means. Other may not. My question is, presuming that Mrs. Hutchinson's testimony is essentially truthful, and that's a big presumption at this point, but we took a big step towards that presumption with her testimony. Now what we have is the President of the United States attempting to lead an armed mob to the Capitol, and some people have said within the Capitol. Huh. That's a BFD. I would like to hear your responses from your people there. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan. We will get to this. But I do want to talk about the difference between what the hearings that we're seeing, or the relationship between the hearings that we're seeing, and a prospective, you know, DOJ, Department of Justice investigation into this. Ankush Kadori, what do you think? I mean, it's a little bit unusual, right? I mean, normally we would have had a criminal investigation go forward before we would have had hearings. So how do you see these two things playing out? And did yesterday change anything in the relationship between these investigations?
You know, the Justice Department's investigation remains a bit of a black box. I mean, obviously, there have been some developments in the last week or so. The raid of Jeffrey Clark's home, former Trump DOJ lawyer, the one who was supposed to be, you know, potentially the acting attorney general. We heard about that prior week. And the seizure of John Eastman's phone, one of the architects, if you will, of the sort of quasi-legal strategy. I mean, that even is charitable to what they were undertaking. It's unclear to, you know, just from the outside, whether and to what extent this is informing or motivating the Justice Department to move in certain directions or more expeditiously, to the point that, you know, all of this is concerning information that should be relevant to a serious criminal investigation. I fully agree. DOJ should have opened this investigation. They should have been investigating at the highest levels of the Trump White House, the Trump campaign, those people who are informally and closely associated with Trump. That investigation should have begun, if not the day Biden took office and the day Merrick Garland took office as the Attorney General in March of last year. It didn't happen so far as we can tell. Something has happened in its place, the contours of which are only sort of now still coming into focus. But I share everyone's revulsion at the details that we're hearing. As a political matter, it's utterly damning. The man is totally, totally morally, temperamentally unfit. He was unfit. He has no business being the president again. I am trying to just focus on the legal ins and outs of what we've heard and the additive quality of what we heard yesterday.
Amy Allison, you know, you've put the question to us, you know, in your view, this is sedition and what are we going to do about it? There's the hearings. That's one thing that's going on. There's this DOJ investigation. That's one thing that's going on. But what about for people who aren't in the government? Like, for in your position, what's the answer to that question to what are we going to do about it?
We have to reestablish political norms. And when I say democratic cultural norms, I mean exactly what we heard from Ankush, but like what is the temperament and practice and behavior of those of us those who are elected and appointed leaders. We have to reestablish that because the Trump administration blew up those established norms. And the question of how we're going to recognize this, you know, criminal acts of sedition and appropriately respond, and even respond to acts of conscience as displayed by Cassidy yesterday in the hearing, where people are coming forward and doing what they can on behalf of, you know, service to this country and adherence to Constitution and democratic and that kind of democratic principles. So, you know, I think right now we have a huge task ahead of us. I agree we should have had, investigations at the highest level that started much earlier, a Justice Department investigation much earlier. But now we have a year out, these revelations about what happened. But we also have not only Trump's behavior, but a whole opposition party, the Republicans, with a couple of exceptions like Liz Cheney, who had a key role yesterday in yesterday's hearing, that have refused to participate in the investigation of the insurrection. The Republicans' refusal has extended the time frame in terms of getting to the bottom of what happened. We have elected members of the government, as it was mentioned earlier, in Congress, still in power after openly, vocally supporting a violent insurrection. So I think that's where average everyday citizens need to demand accountability, legal accountability, not only for Trump, but for those who went along with his criminality and his sedition. And I think for regular people, we want to see a Justice Department have swift and decisive action as a response to these revelations.
Yeah. We're talking about the latest edition of the House committee hearings on the January 6th attack on the Capitol with Amy Allison, founder of She the People, Nicholas Wu, a reporter covering Congress for Politico, and Ankush Kadoria, a lawyer based in Washington, D.C., also contributing writer for New York Magazine's Intelligencer and a contributing editor at Politico Magazine. We would like to hear from you. What were your reactions to the revelations, and what do you think should happen next? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum, or you can email forum@kqed.org. I'm going to try and get to more of your comments and questions right after the break. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the House Committee hearings on the January 6th attack on the Capitol with Ankush Kadori, lawyer based in Washington, contributing writer at New York Mag's Intelligencer, Amy Allison, founder of She the People, Nicholas Wu, reporter covering Congress for Politico. A couple of listener comments. One listener writes, "The Select Committee is so careful and deliberate that the reasons for this surprise session are calculated. They don't want to lose steam and their audience. Lighting a fire under Merrick Garland is an important factor. It's time to start legal proceedings against these seditious politicians. Yesterday was not so much shocking as confirmation of what we know of Trump and what he did and continues to do to undermine our democracy." Valerie writes, "I disagree with your guest who wondered why Cassidy Hutchinson wasn't simply asked her opinion of what Trump's intention was. An opinion is not evidence. This is a very young and vulnerable person who would have been torn apart for even expressing an opinion. It's absolutely right that she was not asked her opinion, but rather was asked to present the facts of what she saw and heard during that week leading up to January 6th. Let's bring in Wynn from Menlo Park. Welcome, Wynn.
Thank you. I believe this woman has total credibility for a very simple reason. She's young. She moved up through the Republican administration into one of the highest jobs in the White House. She is under oath, as one of your guests said. Why in heaven's name would she create any opportunity for her to be found wanting in her testimony?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, Nicholas Wu, come to you on this one. It does seem like she, generally speaking, was received as a credible witness. Obviously, there were some attacks on her credibility by people you might expect, but by and large, she wasn't seen as having a particular axe to grind or those things.
Yes, I mean, we got to remember that Hutchinson was under oath when she gave this testimony. There are consequences if you lie in sworn testimony. And the committee took pains to really show quite how well positioned she was to know and to be in the loop for everything. So, I was in the hearing room yesterday, and at the beginning of the presentation of the hearing, the committee put graphics up on screen showing where exactly her office was, for example, right? Showing that she was directly next to the chief of staff's office, and she was down the hall from the president's office, the Oval Office, and they highlighted how, despite the fact that she was relatively young, she had fairly close ties to top Republican lawmakers. You know, we got to remember that the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, called her on January 6th, trying to get her to talk the president down from coming to the Capitol, right? It seems that there are quibbles around the edges with some of her testimony, but she did present herself as a credible witness.
Yeah. More listener comments coming in. Curtis writes, "The destabilizing of our democracy has already occurred. The GOP is moving away from constitutional norms and installing their own sets of rules. We're now halfway to fascism and passively letting it happen." Amy Allison, you know, you're in touch with a lot of different progressive and democratic orgs, I'm sure. I see this a lot, like this kind of comment when we do shows on these things that, you know, that we're quote unquote passively letting it happen. In your view, is that true, or are people working to counter these kinds of actions and just not succeeding?
In my work with She the People, we work with women of color who are organizing voters on the ground or leading movements. And we have a huge task. Remember, we're only a few months away from the midterm elections. This is our task. Reestablish faith in our constitutional government. You know, we have some people who have said, just vote and vote. Voting is very important. It is one of our duties as a citizen in this country. It is not the only one. We have to really look at what average everyday people are seeing. Not only are we seeing the revelations from yesterday, but we also, you know, more than half of the population had a constitutional right of abortion ended in just the last week. And so just telling people to vote without an appropriate response to this kind of criminal and seditious behavior is just not enough. We have got to reestablish faith in the rule of law, the democratic norms. This is not okay. It isn't okay. And we as a country and as individual citizens are going to stand against that. We need to see legal action. We need to see it sooner rather than later.
Let's bring in Scott from Sausalito. Welcome, Scott. Hey, Scott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, hey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, I just wanted to point out that, everybody also ignores when you put the whole picture together. He sat there for hours after he knowingly sent an armed mob, told him to march down to the Capitol, and then did nothing as everybody begged him to do something. And I just have a question for the attorney. Why was Pat Cipollone so freaked out about him going to the Capitol? He said, when he's literally telling, what charges were they? He goes, we're going to be charged with every crime imaginable. So what is the difference in the fact that he didn't actually go personally down there and the fact that he sent other people there?
Yeah.
I'd like to hear that.
Good question, Scott. Just for Pat Cipollone, White House counsel, I believe, and I wanted to extend that question just a little bit to you, Ankush, which is that what picture really emerges? I mean, the other part of Hutchinson's testimony that we haven't really talked about is this picture emerges of a White House sort of paralyzed with Mark Meadows scrolling on his phone on the couch and Trump locked away in his office watching this occur on television. And then this young aide getting, you know, fielding calls and trying to figure out, you know, what to do. Tell us a little bit about both that picture of the White House and what you think it means, if anything, legally, and then specifically take that question of the White House counsel's concerns.
Okay, so what does it show us, sort of like in the gestalt, if you will? It's a picture of a bunch of feckless morons, okay, running our government. Utterly disturbing, okay? As for Cipollone's commentary, what it reflects is a pretty good lawyer who evidently accurately predicted what sorts of attention they would draw, perhaps correctly, right? And again, I'm just to be very clear, I'm actually resisting the urge to kind of render a decision, if you will, based on yesterday's hearing. I'm kind of reserving judgment. So people are going to be free to come down and sort of take that picture sort of as your caller sort of sketched it out. I'm just reserving judgment. Yeah. I did want to add, though, like on one of the comments, so the person who wrote in to say that her Cassidy Hutchins opinion is like not evidence and it's it wouldn't be allowed at a trial or wouldn't be sort of a permissible evidence. That's not true. as a point of fact, it's not true. Federal Rules of Evidence 701 and 704 actually would allow her to provide opinion testimony like that. It's based on her interpretation of a key fact, based on her percipient testimony and comments she got from Trump herself. So like, I know everyone, you know, is doing their best to sort of deal with complex legal concepts, but I just wanted to correct that. It's not accurate.
Fair enough. I want to get to Susan in Alameda. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, you know, I just feel like asking what should happen here if Trump should be prosecuted, the answer seems to be a no-brainer, absolutely, but he is a man who has said he could shoot someone in the streets of New York and get away with it. And the response to the impeachment, the initial post-investigations, seemed to corroborate him. If thing. I don't blame Merrick Garland for being extremely reluctant.
Think we are losing you, Susan. I'm so sorry about that. I'm gonna go right to Joy in Sonoma. Joy?
Yes, hi. I am just wondering, I really don't know why Trump hasn't been arrested. Why hasn't his passport been confiscated? And what exactly is the legal procedure for this? I'm very confused about the legal procedure. Mm-hmm. If you could explain that to me, I would really be happy because I don't understand what the procedure is for doing this. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you, Joy. You know, I'm going to make sure we have one other caller with a similar question. Daniel in San Francisco, I just want to make sure that we answer your question too on this, on the procedures perhaps for going forward.
Precisely. Thank you. Yeah, I'm assuming that Merrick Garland does actually make the choice to move forward with the prosecution of the president. How would the trial proceed? Obviously, with the impeachment, the Senate is the jury. How would a trial proceed? Who would sit in judgment of the president?
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. Ankush, I think this is another one for you.
Okay, that's a lot. A lot of very good questions. Okay. So under the law, Justice Department prosecutors can seek an indictment of someone if they believe there's probable cause that that person committed a crime. That is a standard that a grand jury undertakes when they review a proposed indictment based on facts that have been presented to them by prosecutors. The government does not actually, however, seek an indictment simply on the basis that they have probable cause. Under Justice Department policy, the prosecutors have to conclude that it is likely that they will be able to obtain a conviction at trial based on the admissible evidence. So that is, and what does that mean, right? You're asking whether at trial you will be able to satisfy each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt of the relevant criminal offense. It's a high standard. So that is sort of like the decision-making architecture, if you will, behind authorizing an indictment and seeking an indictment against anyone. Here we're talking about former President Trump, so obviously this would get the highest, most intense scrutiny imaginable, up to and including Merrick Garland and his closest advisors. In terms of like how a trial would actually unfold, if one were to be brought, you would expect if Trump is charged for any of this, that it would be brought in the District of Columbia, which is where pretty much all of the relevant acts, at least those who have been discussed so far, occurred. It would be not that different from any other criminal trial, to be honest. Mm-hmm. 12 jurors drawn from a jury pool that is the District of Columbia, heavily Democratic jurisdiction. A judge would screen for potential biases and potential conflicts, but it would be like anyone else, presumably a jury of regular Americans.
I just want to say, you know, to the
Amy
earlier
Allison,
caller,
yeah.
I just want to say to the early caller, Susan, who was making the point about, look, this is a twice impeached president. He seems like he could do anything. And I think the legal process is very important for us to know and understand, and I appreciate that, but to understand that what these hearings are doing is building not only the moral case for acting, but also the political case, because it isn't just a legal question. There is a legal process, but we have to have the political will amongst people who currently sit in Congress, amongst those in the Justice Department, to go down this route. And what we need to do as average citizens is speak out clearly. This is what we want. We want action. We want the legal response that's appropriate, and we want in no uncertain terms for our political system and people who are still in power to at all justify or normalize what we have seen from January 6th and for the actors. I also think it's important that we not only look at the case against Trump and his seditious and criminal behavior, but those who enabled him, including sitting members of Congress right now who should be held accountable for their actions around January 6th, along with Trump.
Nicholas Wu, reporter covering Congress for Politico. You know, we did have congressional midterm primaries in a bunch of states. And I wonder, what do you see looking out at that national landscape for Republicans? Is supporting the president still surefire ticket to winning, or are there some cracks in that?
It shows that there's a very nuanced way to support the president, even as some Republicans have expressed criticism of him. Like, look at what happened with the South Carolina primaries not too long ago. Congressman Tom Rice, right, who had voted to impeach Trump, lost his bid for renomination, whereas Congresswoman Nancy Mace, another Republican who had been critical of the president, did not vote to impeach him, and she's won renomination. The same thing goes in last night's primaries. In Illinois, for example, there's one congressman by the name of Rodney Davis, who was a who for the past few cycles has been in a somewhat more purple district. And so, you know, he took somewhat more moderate approaches to deal making in Congress and to talking about the former president. But he got drawn into a into a district with another sitting Republican lawmaker, Mary Miller, who tacked further to the right, garnered Trump's endorsement, had a rally in the district by the former president, boosting her. And we saw Miller prevail over Davis last night. And so in some ways, we still see the long shadow of the former president over the Republican Party and these primaries. And the big test of this is really going to be in the coming months when Congresswoman Liz Cheney faces her primary in Wyoming. Obviously, she's taken on a very visible role on the January 6th committee as its top Republican, and Trump has gone all in on supporting a primary challenger to her. So we'll have to wait and see how exactly that plays out, but that's sure to be very competitive.
You know, listener Art writes in with a question for Amy. Says, thank you for saying we, the American people, should demand legal accountability for sedition by the president. What else can we, the public, do to reestablish democratic norms, as you are asking us to do? What organizations would you suggest we turn to for leadership on this? I'm going to tack on a tiny bit to this. Are there Republicans that you can work with on the other side, what we used to call Never Trump, right? Or are most of the groups that you're working with, you know, really democratic folks who are working to, I guess, bring back these norms on their own?
Most of the thank you for that question, because most of the groups that the people work with are in states like Georgia and Florida, North Carolina, and others. These are people that work on the ground, educating voters, registering voters, turning out voters around issues, a range of issues that serve the community. And so when you look at those who are taking on the responsibility of establishing and strengthening democratic norms, it's the everyday people. I think part of the challenge that we face right now is that, you know, we're citizens in this country. It's our government. And too much of the language has been like, it's somebody else's fault or the responsibility lies with someone else. I think this is our time to activate those in our circle. She the People is one of many organizations who are committed to establishing, reinvigorating, strengthening our democracy, knowing that this kind of, having Trump and his cronies in office with their actions and what happened in this last year cannot be part of a peaceful, strong government. And we need that in order to serve the people. So I think it's a time for us to ask ourselves that question, ourselves and our communities, about what we can do personally. The last thing I will say is what people say and the narrative matters. So speak out and speak loud.
We've been talking about the latest news from the House committee hearings on the January 6th attack on the Capitol with Amy Allison, founder of She the People, an organization elevating the political voice of women of color. Thank you for joining us, Amy. We've also been joined by Nicholas Wu, a reporter covering Congress for Politico, and Ankush Kardori, a lawyer based in Washington and contributing writer for New York Magazine's Intelligencer and a contributing editor at Politico Magazine. Wanted to end with a comment. Gallegos tweets, the important fact is that Trump knew they had weapons. He knew they'd be able to walk to the Capitol even if they did not make it to the rally. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Thank you so much to our guests and all our listeners and commenters. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.